Schlachtensee S-Bahn Station. Hello, how nice of you to come and visit me here at the edge of the Grunewald. What's my name? Amelie. No problem, I always forget names too. It's a beautiful day for a little tour through the green soul of Berlin. We will start here at Schlachtensee S-Bahn Station. The station's history is closely linked to the old Wannsee Railway. After all, this was one of its first stops. Both were opened on the 1st of June 1874. In the beginning, Schlachtensee Station had two side platforms. The main building is said to be reminiscent of a Tuscan villa, similar to the one at Lichterfelde West Station. Do you recognize it? The first electric trains of the Berlin S-Bahn departed from this station on the 15th of May 1933. On the outward journey, you will have already noticed that the station is now used by the S1. Our little tour will first take us to the shore of the beautiful lake. If the water is not too cold, why not dip your feet in? Afterwards, we will visit the former home of a prominent resident of the Marinesiedlung, get to know the Rehwiese and its architectural historical treasures, and dive into the world of the magnificent residential area full of villas. Let's walk straight to my favorite lake. I always spend many hours there in the summer. Have you been here before? No? Then let's go there now. Schlachtensee History. The Schlachtensee is shaped like a ribbon, so there are lots of nice little bays and plenty of access to the water. This is where I cool off on a hot summer day, meet up with my friends, or take my little dog for a walk along the shore on the approximately 5.5 kilometer long path. He loves it here. Up ahead, you can also rent stand-up paddle boards. The pros even do yoga while gliding over the water on their special surfboards. Afterwards, you can relax in the restaurant Fischerhütte. The beautiful beer garden invites you to enjoy a cool drink, chips or ice cream. And with the playground, it's always very lively here. By the way, the beer garden is reminiscent of the first fisherman's hut that stood here around 1759. Can you imagine how old the lake is? It is one of the oldest documented places in the Berlin area and was first mentioned in 1242 with the Wendish name Slatensee. What the word Slati means exactly is still disputed. Many assume that it originally came from the Slavic word for golden. Others assume that Slat could refer to a shore fortification made of posts. However, the Slavic settlement Sladop, which was established here at that time, was soon abandoned, and the people moved to nearby Zehlendorf, where they found better conditions for their agriculture. In the 1960s, shards were found in Paul Ernst Park that attest to this settlement. The origins of the lake, of course, go back much further in history. Today's Schlachtensee landscape was formed by the last ice age about 15,000 years ago. In the course of the melting of the ice, elongated lakes were formed, one behind the other, as the meltwater from the glacier surfaces ran down and collected under great pressure, creating so-called glacial troughs. Can you imagine that around 12,000 years ago, small groups of people attentively wandered through this area in summer at a temperature of around 10 degrees Celsius to hunt reindeer? Archaeological research even suggests that there were people in the Schlachtensee area for the first time around 350,000 years ago. But because all evidence of settlement here has been covered up during several ice ages, it can no longer be definitely proven. In my environmental protection group, I work with other committed people to preserve and protect this area with its long history and enormous ecological relevance as a green space in the city. The popular Krumme Lanke bathing lake is also close by. Do you know the song about Krumme Lanke by Freddy Sieg? Why not listen to it when you get the chance? You can learn a little Berlin dialect in the process. Now I have the song in my head and have completely forgotten how I wanted to continue. Ah yes, the Paul Ernst Park. You can also go for a nice walk or jog in this park, which is on the south bank opposite the S-Bahn station. Does the name Paul Ernst mean anything to you? The park is named after the writer and journalist Paul Ernst, who lived from 1866 to 1933. Shortly before his death, he was nominated for the Nobel Prize for Literature and appointed to a seat at the Prussian Academy of Arts that had become vacant after Jewish people had been driven out of the art world in the course of the National Socialist program of so-called Gleichschaltung. Perhaps you have heard of Paul Ernst or read an excerpt from his dramas, stories, novellas, epics, or essays. In German class, I got to know him as a representative of the neoclassical movement. Willy Brandt's residence. Continue to the left in the direction of Marienesteig 14. We are now in the middle of the popular residential area of the Marinesiedlung that is located above the southern shore of Schlachtensee. The residential area consists of two-story semi-detached houses. These four-family houses contain flats of more than 100 square meters for each family. The beige-colored rough plaster and the hipped roofs make the houses look very inconspicuous. Now I'll show you one of my personal highlights of this area. There it is in front of us. Yes, I mean that inconspicuous brownish house. I'm sure you know the name of the person who lived here. Have you noticed the plaque on the house? It's sometimes covered with ivy. That's right. It's the famous politician Willy Brandt of the center-left party SPD, who was first the governing mayor of Berlin and then chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany from 1969 to 1974. When I hear his name, I think straight away of his so-called New Eastern policy, which meant a course of entente and reconciliation with the German Democratic Republic, GDR, and the Warsaw Pact states. In 1971, he even received the Nobel Peace Prize for it. We want to risk more democracy, Willy Brandt said in his first government declaration on the 28th of October 1969. This sentence did not attract much attention at the time. The opposition centre-right party, CDU-CSU, found another one of his declarations far more provocative. We want to be and become a nation of good neighbours, both domestically and abroad. Only in retrospect did the announcement of wanting to dare to risk more democracy become one of the most famous politicians' quotes and symbolic for the reforms that were to change West Germany in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Why exactly did he live here with his family, you may ask? I think an article in the Berliner Zeitung from the 26th of June 2010 describes it quite well. I have it as a PDF on my mobile phone, and I'm happy to translate you an excerpt now. The charismatic SPD politician lived on the shores of the Schlachtensee during his tenure as president of the Abgeordnetenhaus, that's the Berlin Parliament, and later also, for a few years, as governing mayor, in a setting that was certainly enchanting, yet close to the people and modest. At least if you apply today's standards. The neighbourhood doesn't seem highly fashionable, but smart, homely and absolutely ideal for children. Why is this residential area called Marinesiedlung? When Austria became part of National Socialist Germany and numerous synagogues were being set on fire in the German streets, the architect Rudolf Kühn began to realize his design for the Marinesiedlung here in the district of Steglitz-Zehlendorf. The five-year construction phase, which began in 1938, was managed by the gemeinnützige GmbH für Schaffung von Wohnangelegenheiten von Reichsangehörige, freely translated as the non-profit limited liability company for the creation of housing for members of the Reich. As the name suggests, this housing area was explicitly planned for naval personnel. In the course of the mobilization and enlargement of the Navy for the Second World War, housing for senior naval officers became increasingly necessary. On the 29th of March 1939, the housing estate was officially named Marinesteig, which means marine path. At that time, the residents of the estate consisted mainly of captains and staff officers. Fascinating, isn't it? With the end of the war, this settlement developed into a popular residential area. Today, the naval settlement is protected as a cultural heritage. Some of the buildings were renovated between 2000 and 2005. The residents appreciate the peace and quiet of the Marinesiedlung and describe it as their Bullerbö in the big city of Berlin. Haus Levin. Feel free to take a few more photos here. Now we'll go back up along Schlachtensee and through the subway onto Krottnauer Straße. Now turn left onto Waldsängerpfad and at number 3 you can see Haus Levin. With this house, we get to know an outstanding modernist villa. Built between 1929 and 1930 by Peter Behrens, it was intended for the psychologist Kurt Levin, who as a Jew had to emigrate to the USA in 1933. In Behrens's work, this house marks his turning towards new objectivity. I would now like to tell you a little more about him, because he really fascinates me. The beginning of objective and industrial design in architecture is often associated with the person of Peter Behrens. He recognized earlier than others the important position of industry in social life and immersed himself deeply in the language of industrial form. His works were always based on the premise of combining art and technology. This connection can be seen, for example, in Behrens's design for the German embassy in St. Petersburg. There he decided to furnish the interior with numerous products of German industrial culture. He is particularly known for his extensive design work as an artistic advisor for AEG before the First World War. AEG stands for Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft and was one of the world's largest producers of electrical equipment at the time. Incidentally, Behrens also developed the world's first corporate identity design for them. Have you ever heard of this? Corporate identity design aims to provide an image that is uniform across a company. The architectural office led by Behrens gained special significance because several architects who later became famous, among them Walter Gropius, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, and Le Corbusier, worked there around the same time as him. In his lifetime, Peter Behrens created many buildings with which he initiated the transition from Art Nouveau to the rationalism of the Bauhaus period. He was also very involved in the organization of associations. For example, he was co-founder of the well-known Munich Secession, the Vereinigte Werkstätten für Kunst und Handwerk, freely translated the Unified Workshops for Art and Handcraft, and the German Werkbund. With the founding of the Zehnerring, he pursued the unification of all modern architectural trends. Behrens also taught his understanding of art at several state institutions. From 1902 to 1903, he directed the master classes at the Bavarian Gewerbemuseum in Nuremberg, was subsequently director of the Düsseldorf Kunstgewerbeschule, a school of applied arts, and in 1922 taught at the Vienna Academy of Fine Arts. He got around quite a bit, didn't he? He continued his work even during the Nazi era, working with Hitler's chief architect Albert Speer from 1934 onwards. 2 years later, he became head of the master studio at the Prussian Academy of Arts. Behrens died in 1940 in Berlin. Of course, a house is not only determined by its architecture, but also by the people who live in it. Have you already discovered the plaque commemorating the former owner of the house? The Vienna-born actor and director Fritz Wisten, who was also the artistic director of the Jewish Cultural Association at the time, lived here from 1934 to 1962. His career began after the First World War at the German Theatre in Stuttgart. He won the hearts of audiences with numerous character roles, for example as Mephisto in Goethe's Faust, and by participating in plays such as The Green Cockadoo by Arthur Schnitzler and The Captain of Köpenick by Karl Zuckmayer. You can imagine that the year 1933 heralded a turning point in his career. Under National Socialist rule, his merits were quickly forgotten and his contract at the Landestheater was not renewed. He left Stuttgart and hoped to continue his career in Berlin. The Jüdische Kulturbund, a Jewish cultural association, eventually engaged him as artistic director and stage manager. During the November pogrom of 1938, Wisten was taken to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp and imprisoned there. However, he was very lucky and was soon released. Because of his marriage to Gertrud Wittmann, a non-Jewish actress from Stuttgart, he was able to avoid further deportation, but he had to do forced labor until the end of the Second World War. The Wisten couple temporarily hid Jews in this house. After the end of the war, Wisten joined the Deutsche Theater in Berlin and took over as director of the Theater am Schiffbauerdamm. From 1953 to 1961, he was director of the Volksbühne Berlin. Wisten received numerous awards and honors, such as the National Prize of the GDR, second class, and the Goethe Prize of the City of Berlin. In 1960, on the occasion of his 70th birthday, he was awarded the Fatherland Order of Merit in silver. He died here in his home 2 years later. I always find it fascinating what stories old houses can tell. Let's move on to Krottnauer Straße number 8. Have you already spotted the fenced-in house with the flags? That's right, it's an embassy. But do you know which country it belongs to? A little hint. You can see the coat of arms on the cornice of the building. Judging by the architecture of the house, you can tell that it must have been built around 1900. Strictly speaking, it was built between 1899 and 1900 by the Heimstetten Aktiengesellschaft, HAG for short, as one of their most prestigious houses in Schlachtensee. Today, it is the residence of the Croatian embassy. Giant oak at the Rehwiese. Let's now walk further along Matterhornstraße to the Rehwiese. This narrow, almost 1.5 kilometer long lowland, which stretches from Spanische Allee to Nikolassee, is a small piece of paradise. It was probably formed around 22,000 BC and was called Kufen by the early residents of the so-called Nikolassee villa colony. If you take a walk here, you can enjoy absolute peace and quiet, at least in summer, and excepting the chirping of birds. Even at its northern edge, the lush greenery swallows up any car noise, although only a few bushes separate the busy Spanische Allee from this idyll. If you listen carefully, you're sure to hear a few birds in the treetops. You might even recognize particular bird calls. We are now approaching a natural wonder. Yes, you heard right, in the middle of the capital. From the Rehwiese bus stop, which you can easily reach by taking the 112 bus, this jewel is not yet visible. But a staircase behind the bus stop leads down to our next stop. Please be careful, the steps are a bit uneven and there is no railing to hold onto. If that's too wobbly for you, you can also walk around the long way. Can you see it yet? It's a giant oak tree over 30 meters high. It has been standing here for more than 250 years. Its trunk and its strong roots, embedded in the earth, could tell a lot of stories. Its life began at the end of the 18th century when technical progress was increasingly determining life in Europe, and movements for unification and freedom were spreading. Nature also changes with the times. At that time, this oak tree was still part of the Marshy Rehwiese, or Deer Meadow. An ice age gully that surrounded by the alluvial forest was part of the Grunewald Lakes. At that time, the Nikolassee built-up area of today was still dominated by unspoiled nature. At the great trunk of this oak, one senses the power of nature and also our task to protect it. Such large trees also play an important role in the ecosystem. Especially in built-up cities, trees provide many insects, birds and bats with a vital habitat and thus protection. This promotes species conservation. Another famous oak has had a permanent place in the heart of Berlin for several centuries. I am talking about the large oak tree on the northern edge of Lake Tegel, which became known by the nickname Fat Marie. It is said to be around 900 years old, making it the oldest tree in Berlin. Fascinating, isn't it? For almost a whole millennium, it has been observing the hustle and bustle of the capital from its vantage point. Fat Marie also marveled at some celebrities, such as the Humboldt brothers, who gave it the nickname. Even Goethe stopped by Fat Marie during a visit to the Humboldts in 1778 and listened to the wind cutting its way through the branches. Let's get back to our oak tree. I'd like to close my eyes one last time and listen to the rustling of the leaves before we continue our circuit. By the way, I'm really glad that the giant oak tree and the Nicolaceae have been under nature conservation since 1960 and will thus continue to be preserved. The Rehwiese itself is also a landscape under protection. On the left along Gergradstraße, number 4, number 9, number 12. We now turn left into Gergradstraße to discover some magnificent cultural monuments from the time when the villa quarter was built. First of all, I would like to tell you the story of house number 4. This house was designed between 1909 and 1910 by the architect Emilie Winkelmann, who was the first woman in Germany to study architecture and who became a freelance architect. Although she achieved great fame as a successful architect during her lifetime, her extensive creative period has so far only been explored in a rudimentary way. We will now discover one of her works. Here in Nikolassee and in Zehlendorf, the Berlin architect built several single-family houses that exhibit a cottage style typical of the time. With her extraordinary talent for design and the constructional quality of her works, she stood out from the competition and developed into an esteemed architect. From 1916 onwards, a chronic hearing disorder restricted Emilie Winkelmann in her work. In 1928, she was nevertheless accepted into the Association of German Architects. She refused to join the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP for short, after the onset of National Socialist rule. Not surprisingly, she hardly received any commissions as a result. Emilie Winkelmann's life ended in 1951 at Gut Hovedissen near Bielefeld. Now that we have gained a little insight into the life of Emilie Winkelmann, I would like to direct your gaze to the single-story, light-colored, plastered building with its high mansard roof and turret. We are standing here in front of Julie Meyer's country house and can sense particularly well in this house the solidity and comfort of the upper middle classes, which is directly expressed in the design of the villa quarters in West Berlin. Emilie Winkelmann's design features a strictly symmetrical house facade with a veranda and a balcony supported by columns. The interior is generously proportioned. Anyone moving in here will find a hallway, living rooms and utility rooms on the ground floor. A staircase leads to the upper floor, where the bathroom and bedrooms are. Incidentally, between 1978 and 1999, this property housed a residential home run by the German Red Cross. Today, the house is in private use again. Continuing on to house number 9, this architectural monument was also built at the beginning of the 20th century, to be precise, in 1905 to 1907, by the architect Otto Stahn, for the mine owner Richard Schröder. With its quarry stone outer shell, the very representative villa was one of the most expensive in Nikolassee at the time, and it really stands out from the rest of the villa quarter. I don't even want to know the exact costs. It is also worth taking a closer look at the house at number 12 Gergradstraße. The magnificent villa was built in 1902 to 1903 to a design by the government master builder Georg Königsberger for the schoolmaster Dr. Fritz Bremer. Bremer was one of the first residents of the villa quarter and a great lover of nature. This explains why he chose to settle in this green part of Berlin. Lindeneck and Schöneck. Also beautifully situated at the Rehwiese near the junction of Normannenstraße are our next points of call. From the Rehwiese you can see two similar buildings that were completed almost simultaneously. Have you spotted them? Look, viewed from the Rehwiese they resemble a gate. Haus Henneberg, formerly called Schöneck, is located opposite Haus Lindeneck at Rehwiese 11. The Lindeneck house was designed by the architect Franz Maywald in 1902 to 1903. Although a lot was changed during the conversion into an apartment building in 1999 to 2002, from the windows and balconies to the entrance area and roof, the original shape of the house and its special appearance are still clearly preserved. In front of you, you see a two-story villa with a clinker brick plinth and a high-hipped roof. With half-timbered gables, arbors, oriels and verandas, it appears playful and lively. The neighbouring house also displays the typical character of the Nicolassé villa quarter in its earliest development phase. The Linden Egg still corresponds strongly to the traditional architecture of the late 19th century, but its decorative elements also show signs of the transition to the modern cottage style of the dawning 20th century. Let us now turn our gaze to the house opposite, the Villa Hennenberg on the southern corner, which was also called Schöneck at the time. The owner of the house, Rudolf Henneberg, was an engineer, entrepreneur and member of the German Reichstag. In the villa quarter of Nicolassé near Berlin that was founded in 1901, Henneberg had the stately villa built on the Rehwiese in 1902 to 1903 by the property development company Heimstetten AG. The house, with its historicized elements, stands out from the somewhat more modern-looking neighboring houses. Do you notice the historicizing elements? They include the high plinth, the tower, the ornamental half-timbering, the Gothic windows and the balustrade. Incidentally, the frigate captain Johannes Wanselau and the chemist, chess master and writer Oskar Kordel were neighbors of Henneberg. The group of houses at An der Rehwiese 12 to 15 has largely been preserved in its original condition and is listed as an ensemble. Mittelhof. We remain at the Rehwiese and proceed to Kirchweg 31, to the Mittelhof country house and garden. Here we have come to a place with a turbulent history. During the First World War, the famous Berlin architect Hermann Muthesius designed this building complex for the entrepreneur and industry magnate Wilhelm Mertens. Originally, the design envisaged the construction of an idyll, but I think the whole thing looks rather gloomy. What do you think? The massive house presses deep into the terrain, which slopes down to the Rehwiese. The dark pine trees and the house make an ideal location for a horror film, don't you think? It also reminds me a little of a Lower Saxon manor house. You too? The Mittelhof was built on the model of English country houses. The property can only be entered through a wide wooden gate that opens onto a 70-meter-long birch-lined avenue leading to the building. The architectural design of a central square, from which the remaining parts emanate, established the name Mittelhof. The naming surprised everyone at the time, as it was customary for new villas to be named after the first people to live there. But who was the owner who had this 600-square-meter property built for himself, his wife and their four children? You already know his name, Wilhelm Mertens. Although the family of this increasingly well-known entrepreneur enjoyed the advantages of the villa quarter in its prime location and surrounded by Berlin's upper middle classes, he sealed himself and his family off from the outside world on his property. I would now like to go into more detail about his activities as a trader in colonial goods. Surely you are aware that trading in goods from the colonies must be viewed against the background of the exploitation of the colonies and slavery. The current critical view and recognition of the violence and suffering of the population of former colonies due to their exploitation started very late and is still far from being widespread enough. Mertens also drew wealth and prestige from this process of exploitation through his activity as a colonial trader. He traded with various plantation companies, especially in rubber and bananas. He also traded with mining and commodity syndicates who extracted metals such as tin, gold, and ore. Mertens carried out his questionable business in colonies in Africa as well as Southeast Asia. Following a legal case against him, his reputation as a trader was damaged. Nevertheless, shortly after the proceedings, he commissioned one of the most famous architects of the time to build his new residence. However, the outbreak of the First World War meant that Mertens was no longer able to access his funds held abroad and therefore fell into arrears with the payments for the house. The Treaty of Versailles forced Germany to cede its colonies, so Mertens also lost his properties there. After the First World War, the family did finally move into their new home, but only 2 years later, due to lack of income, they were forced to move to a smaller property. That was still a very stately villa, very close to the one here, but it was only about half the size. No other family would ever move into Muthesius's extravagant villa again. The former trader in colonial goods sold his house to the two Henkel von Donnersmarck brothers, who used the property as a headquarters for their burgeoning real estate business. The Henkel von Donnersmarck brothers sold it again, and in 1938, the Nazi Reichskulturkammer set up its office here. I'm sure you've heard of it in your history class. The main goal of the Reich Chamber of Culture was the state organization, supervision and control of culture. Accordingly, the Reich Chamber of Culture served to bring culture into line in order to control all areas of society. Anyone working in the field of art and culture had to join a specific chamber. Those who could not provide proof of Aryan origin were not admitted, or if they already belonged to a chamber, were excluded again. By the way, the position in the National Socialist hierarchy determined the allocation of rooms in the villa. The head of the Reich Chamber of Culture naturally moved into the most prestigious and imposing room, the dining hall with its barrel vault. The large entrance hall became the waiting room for supplicants, and the other rooms housed chambers for the Reich propaganda ministry. The so-called Künstlerdank, a donation office of the Dr. Joseph Goebbels Foundation for actors in need, was set up on the lower floor. With Law No. 2 of the 10th of October 1945, the Reich Chamber of Culture was banned by the Allied Control Council and its property was confiscated. US soldiers maintained an officers' club in the Mittelhof after the war. Subsequently, people from the old people's home of deaconesses from East Prussia moved in. Can you imagine why the Muthesius Villa was almost demolished after the sisters moved out in the mid-1970s? The maintenance of the house was too expensive, the space too large, and the location too far from the city centre. Fortunately, the Volkswagen Foundation supported the preservation of the villa and acquired it for the Historical Commission of Berlin, which still conducts its research on regional history in the imposing property. It now shares the building with another research centre, Zentrum Moderner Orient. So today, a completely different atmosphere prevails here. Every day, experts from the fields of history, sociology, anthropology, psychology, and economics come together in the Mittelhof. At noon, they meet for lunch in the wood-paneled 64-square-meter large entrance hall, under whose ceiling a model of a two-masted sailing ship used to hang. Not much of the original furnishings remain. Yes, you're right. It's really fascinating what history some buildings can remind us of. Unfortunately, the Mittelhof is not open to the public. But during the annual Open Monument Day, you can also discover the moving history of the Mittelhof from the inside. Nicholas See Church and Rectory. If you like, we can now take a little excursion. From here, you already have a good view of the Nicholas See Church and Rectory. The Nicholas See Church was built together with the rectory at the beginning of the 20th century. The church, rectory and entire forecourt are now listed as cultural property. I find the large clock on the steeple particularly beautiful. Go and have a look at the church. I'll be waiting for you here. Teutonenstraße 24. Our walk takes us further to the right into Mittelbusch. From there, at Julius-Posener-Platz, we turn right again into Teutonenstraße, where there is another magnificent house to see. Yes, I couldn't believe it at first either how many beautiful cultural monuments there are around the Rehwiese. The listed building at No. 24 Teutonenstraße was designed in 1905 to 1906 by August Höhne for the jeweler Erich Rudolf and used to be called the Rudelsburg. Going right along Prinz Friedrich Leopold Straße, where two of the first buildings of the villa quarter are to be seen in a preserved state. Please turn right into Prinz Friedrich Leopold Straße, which is about 900 meters long. Did you know that this street once led directly to the Nikolassee? These days you have to go through a pedestrian tunnel to get to the lake. Incidentally, the street begins at Hohenzollernplatz, which we will explore later, and ends at the noise barrier of Libellenstraße. You are now going down a road that is more than 100 years old. Between 1901 and 1904, Prinz Friedrich Leopold Straße was laid out by Heimstetten AG, and its name was entered in the Fahrer city map just 1 year later. Perhaps you are also interested in the person who gave this street its name. The street's namesake, Friedrich Leopold, full name Joachim Karl Wilhelm Friedrich Leopold, Prince of Prussia, was a brother-in-law of Emperor Wilhelm II and lived from 1865 to 1931. As family tradition dictated, he completed a military career. At the age of 10, he was already a lieutenant, and in 1907 he became Inspector General of the Army, although by this time he was only formally pursuing his military duties. At the age of 24, Luise, Princess of Schleswig-Holstein-Sonderburg, the sister of the German Empress, became his wife. Prince Friedrich Leopold caused quite a lot of commotion and gossip within the ruling family. As an enfant terrible, he indulged himself in expensive luxuries and became entangled in costly legal cases, which also caused quite a public stir. Finally, even Kaiser Wilhelm II himself got involved and ordered a secret investigation into the private life of the prince and his wife. Sounds like a Hollywood script, doesn't it? As a result of the investigation, the couple was largely excluded from social life. Despite his military training, Prince Leopold spent the period of the First World War here in Berlin on the quietly situated estate of Klein Glienicke, not far from the Glienicke Landscape Park in Wannsee. The November Revolution of 1918 marked the end of the monarchy, and for the prince also the end of the paternalism of the emperor, whom he particularly angered on the 10th of November by hoisting a red flag on the roof of his estate. You may be wondering why anything was named after him at all. Well, here in Nikolassee, the prince also took some positive measures. For example, he strongly supported the settlement of the villa quarter. The Düppel Forest belonged to his estate and until 1900 also the Kuhfen, already known to you as the Rehwiese. Today, the Prinz Leopold Canal, which connects Griebnitzsee with the Stölpchensee, is also a reminder of the fun and scandal-loving prince. So, enough about Prince Leopold. Let's get back to the actual street. Most of the houses were built before 1914. There are numerous villas and country houses near the station, and also houses with shops on the ground floor. At the time, Heimstetten AG described the street as Nikolassee's main street and as the widest avenue adorned with a strip of gardens. Today, Prinz Friedrich Leopold Straße is, above all, one thing. Very quiet. At the north end of the street, there are also a few shops to discover. Here you are also well catered for, with a bistro and two restaurants, in case you have become hungry. Towards the south, the street's surroundings change. There you will find magnificent houses on large plots of land, surrounded by lots of greenery. Please take a look at number 26, the address of the Schweizer Villa, which was built in 1901 for the publisher Otto Thiele, according to designs by Reinhold Rode. Also worth seeing is the listed building at number 18. A house that the architect and master mason Georg Bamborschke completed in just 1 year, from 1902 to 1903, for the factory owner Hermann Schucker. Now we'll head for the last stop on our tour and walk to the end of the street to Hohenzollernplatz. Hohenzollernplatz. Coming out of Nikolassee S-Bahn station, you will immediately see Hohenzollernplatz, which is adorned with two female figures. On the left, in front of the former Nikolassee Town Hall and today's headquarters of police, Section 43, is Die Bogenspannerin, or freely translated, Woman Drawing a Bow. On the right, Die Badende, or Bathing Woman. The latter is a beauty with a strange name. The statue by the sculptor Ferdinand Lepke is described as a Frühne. The translation of this name, of the graceful figure, is very curious, because Frühne means toad. However, Lepke chose this name quite deliberately and decided to place a famous hetaira or courtesan of ancient Greece here on the Hohenzollernplatz. The young Greek woman lived in the 4th century BC and was originally called Mnesarete, which can be translated as remembering virtue. Frühne was known throughout the country for her beauty and often posed as a model for statues. Her nickname Frühne, which was an allusion to her yellowish complexion, became established. Today, unfortunately, we can no longer admire the original made by Lepke in 1900. It disappeared during the Second World War, which is why a replica was commissioned and was still in the meadow not far from Schlachtensee S-Bahn station until 2008. Due to vandalism, Nicolassee was then chosen as the new home of the beautiful Fröne. Terrible, these graffiti. But they are the reason we have her here with us now. A special eye-catcher is also the candelabra that were erected here on Hohenzollernplatz at the beginning of the 20th century. The elaborately decorated and multi-armed street light is now under protection. Unfortunately, not all five lights always work, as it is not always possible to find spare parts for historic lamps. Gas lanterns also use a lot of energy, which is why many have been replaced in recent years with electrically powered ones or LEDs. Do you know when the first lighting was seen on the streets? In fact, the first oil lanterns brought light to the streets of Hamburg as early as 1665. Berlin followed almost 15 years later with an oil lantern in front of every third house. You can find more information about the origins of the Nicolassee and Schlachtensee villa quarters on the red information boards. Nicolassee S-Bahn Station. Unfortunately, I have to leave you now because I have another appointment. I really hope you enjoyed our little tour from Schlachtensee to Nicolassee. I really enjoyed exploring the history of my neighborhood with you. The S-Bahn lines 1 or 7 will take you back to the center of Berlin easily and quickly. However, I would strongly recommend that you look around a bit more in Nicolassee. You can stroll around at leisure in the southern Libellenstraße and Simbahnstraße, or further west through Schopenhauerstraße, Lückhofstraße and von Luckstraße. There are simply so many buildings here that are worth seeing and so steeped in history that a single stroll is not nearly enough to discover them all. By the way, if you follow the Alemannenstraße south from here, you will come to the lake after which the part of the district is named. I wish you lots of fun and hope to see you here in Nicolassee again soon. Goodbye!